Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here, and sitting across from me,
making faces at Steve, and he's a professional. He did not break up once.
No.
No.
That's because I can't see your face behind the microphone.
I see. All right. Here we are on our next edition of what's the name of the show? Democratic Perspective. And we have a wonderful, wonderful guest that we just heard speak, as we often do. We take speakers from the Democrats of the Red Rocks Breakfast, and we haul them down here to the radio studio, and we explore their ideas a little further. And today we have Damian Preciado, who has a multitude of credits going on. And we want to talk about his political evolution this morning, and he talked about some of the organizations that he's involved with. One of the things that I like the most, Damian Preciado from Phoenix, Arizona, came up to speak to Democrats of the Red Rocks, and we talked about a Democratic think tank, which I find fascinating. Certainly the premier or the most well-known Republican think tank is the Goldwater Institute, that has probably done more harm and caused more suffering in Arizona than the other criminal.
I actually get their emails. Somebody put me on the list. And they're gloating all the time about stuff that we hate. We also have Karen McClellan here, who's been on the Sedona School Board for years, been the president of the board, and was the president of DOR for many years, and now is head of programming and speakers at DOR. And you invited this guy up here, right?
Yeah.
Karen is kind of one of our go-to people at Democratic Perspective here.
No, we invited Damian Preciado and Jevin Hodge, who unfortunately couldn't stay for the show. They're both vice chairman of the Arizona Democratic Party this year, but they also represent the generation of people we don't see in Sedona as much, in millennials and younger. So we brought them up to talk about, since they're sort of the face of the future of the party. They're the people who are in their 30s now, or in their 20s, who are now starting to get involved, running think tanks, running for office. And the people we're going to be voting for U.S. Senator in 10 years, or president in 20 years.
We do want to do a little shout-out to Sedona XYZ. We realize we have our own millennial-centered, anyway, group. And by Sedona XYZ, they're all of those generations. But they are not a political group at all. Matter of fact, one of the things I want to do on the air is encourage them to become more political. It is not something to avoid. It is something to embrace. Right, Damian?
Correct. Yeah, there's definitely a lot they can do to influence policy in a positive way without taking, overtly partisan positions.
Tell us focus a little on the bit issues. About yourself, Damian. Mm-hmm.
Well, how far back would you like to
go? Let's talk about your political
awakening. At your age, we can't go back that far.
Let's talk about your political awakening, because it was certainly similar to lots of stories.
Thank you for asking there. I became a citizen in 2008. Always aware, following the news, following, the happenings. But I wasn't able to vote until after then, and I didn't really feel Even though I could have participated, I felt like I couldn't. It wasn't, something that was a top priority at the time. But over time, I came to realize, or more fully realize, that there's been a lot of investments, a lot of resources, times of just love and affection from family and friends and mentors. So ultimately, why I got involved is all of this investment and time and energy that went into me, sacrifice, really, that everyone had put in. I had an obligation, a genuine obligation to give back to my immediate community, to my country, to everyone as a whole. I was alarmed with the rhetoric coming from our candidates, at the time, and coming from a more technical background in both business and academia. I really started to look at how the government or how the parties are actually structured, doing the research on their bylaws, on their operating documents, trying to figure out who's who and actually who influences what. So I became very familiar with the role of what's called a precinct committee person. That is the most basic voting member of the Arizona, of the any Democratic, any party, whether it's Republican or Democrat. Those positions are allotted based on the number of registered members of each party on a precinct basis in the state. So generally speaking, if there are 125 voters for your party in your precinct, you're allotted one precinct committee person per that number of registered voters. What I saw in the numbers is even though we had – I saw two things. One is that the Democratic Party was behind, you know, in the number of precinct committee people. And like I said, being a student of history, I knew that if you want to win a war, you need a ratio of 3-1.
You need some
You need some soldiers.
Yeah.
And so and when I saw that, I'm like, okay, we're literally 3-1 behind. Like this is not a good position to be in. So we started focusing myself and others on recruiting precinct committee people, because that position is actually a voting member of the infrastructure, not just of the Democratic Party at the time, so you can vote for a candidate, but a voting member of the infrastructure of the party, which allows you to run for legislative district chair positions or to serve on the board. You can run for your county chairs, serve on the board. You run for state, where I sit, you know, as a vice chair. And that's where that pool of individuals, that's where our DNC membership come from.
Well, that's it. I'm going to interrupt and say, and that's what I learned, too, is that, that those levels of involvement, you can be involved politically, and I'm directing this to our audience here a little bit, that certainly these times are getting more and more people involved politically. And you can be involved politically at all kinds of levels. But as Damian found out, and as I found out years before, is that the precinct committee level is like maybe the goal, or certainly the rung that you are really involved now. Now you are politically involved. Now you're understanding the politics. And like, as you also pointed out, it's either party, but I didn't care about the other party. I was pretty much focused on the Democratic Party. Because it was the only reasonable positions that I could find. Mm-hmm. It was the place that they had the LGBT caucus and the Veterans Caucus. There was there was no such thing in the Republican Party, and might still, I'm sure there still isn't, at least on the LGBT side. But they didn't even have a Veterans Caucus. You thought that, so it's why these, and in those days, those are the kinds of things I was interested in, and a Women's Caucus and so on. I remember they had a Women's Auxiliary, which I found, you know, this sort of separate organization, which I found hilarious in the new millennium. But go ahead. I don't mean that.
Well, no, and when people complain, you know, oftentimes about how their vote doesn't count, even when they're registered to vote and they go and they vote for a candidate and they're not elected, or they say, hey, the party isn't doing, you know, what I want or what I think should happen, being a precinct committee person is a way to have your voice actually heard. It's not just an opinion. You're a voting member of the organization. You can propose resolutions. You can organize things in ways that actually have impact. Somebody needs to teach you, you know, or you have to take the initiative to learn how you can be most effective. But unless you get that ticket to be a part of that team, then you're just another outsider, you know, opining but not, you know, with no buy-in.
Right. I mean, if you go to the party and say, oh, I have a lot of really interesting opinions, and they're going to kind of look at you, well, have you participated at all or done anything?
Yeah. And it's not to discourage people who have ideas, you know, and haven't done it in the past, but also be realistic about, you know, when you see something that's broken, you can't just go and yell at the whoever's there right now. You have to identify why it's broken, see what level of repair it's in. Sometimes it will be nothing, and you'll identify and you can build something. Oftentimes you'll find out that there has been mitigating factors to allowing something that you consider simple to have been accomplished in the past.
I want to go back to your remark that the political parties seem weak, and that there was a point a couple of decades ago where the political parties in the Democratic Party in Mississippi and Alabama and not Montana but Wyoming were basically filing cabinets with very, very few people involved. Their Reagan years had sort of gutted the Democratic Party in a lot of ways. But American political parties are very democratic compared to maybe some European parties, but they're also less disciplined and they have less power, right? They're weak compared to, say, the Labour Party in England.
Yeah, I can't speak to, you know, the European politics as well as you would as you are, you know, but 100%, you know, when you have a organization whose membership is meant to be 10,000 people and that membership is only 1,500 people, and then in reality when you start looking at large numbers and participation of those 1,500, probably a third of them are engaged, and of those third there's probably a tenth that actually take on responsibilities, you know, so all this power and influence, you know, is just
diluted.
Yeah. Yes, and the parties, when they're weak that way, they lend themselves to being co-opted by the special interests, who for a fraction of the cost can have a handful of people, you know, start to propose the resolutions, start to block away the kind of candidates that would be, you know, more balanced candidates, you know, less extreme ones for either party, you know, it's just without a functioning, working party body, you know, then it's everything is up for grabs, and people don't understand how fundamental that power is, and how it translates to the national stage, and ultimately the global stage, because what we do sets the standards for countries around the world.
I like your analysis of the very realistic analysis of party structure and how many people are actually involved in the end. And I think that's really, you're thinking about things differently than most people I know. You're looking at it really structurally. And I think there's a lot of things that need to be said. When I moved to Arizona, I was impressed with the openness of the Democratic Party, and also the weakness of the party. But what I found was just tons and tons of good people, and all the stereotypes about Democrats. I mean, I found they were untrue. I mean, I moved here from New York City, mm-hmm. where it's all political clubs.
And there really are cigar smoking rooms.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you know, I never joined any of them. You know. But here it was open, but the party was weak and had not really rebuilt itself over the years. And so I think that your analysis, and Karen, that's pretty much it. And yeah. Dorr is one of the strongest non-precinct-based groups in the state. It has a large membership. It is very active. And when I came here, I got involved in Dorr. It was fading. It was the old leadership left, and so mm-hmm. new leadership came in. It's very important to get involved in politics, and I think your point is good. As when you're a member of the party, the way you're a member of the party and a precinct person and stuff, then you're a voter. You have real power in the party if people agree with you, and you have a chance to talk at party meetings and stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. We all know how important it is to vote, and it's the kind of position that if you have a sense of civic responsibility and pride, it is there for you. And I know that more people feel that way than the number of positions that are filled. There's just a variety of obstacles that need to be addressed, like, you know, even just the application process in Maricopa County. It's easier in smaller counties, but in Maricopa County, where you have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people, that's the bulk of them. I think it's like 6,000. That's where the major allotment is. You know, processing an application can take, you know, weeks, if not months, because it's all paper-based and it has to go through legislative districts and counties. So there's all this bureaucracy, and unless you understand that, you can become frustrated and feel like maybe they didn't want you and misinterpret things. So there are so many things that we have to quietly work on fixing as well, just to process an application so that the the doors are actually open, not just the jar.
I'm going to change directions here. We're listening to Damian Preciado, vice chair of Arizona Democratic Party. We want to talk about a little more about stuff that you've done. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you focused on was financial literacy. So I want to talk about those two things, mm-hmm. financial literacy and the white hat Democrats, mm-hmm. which has evolved, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. before the mics were turned on. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about what did you do regarding financial literacy, Damian?
Well, that's an excellent question. It feels like ages ago, too. When I, as I mentioned, I worked in finance, and I did that for 10 years. I was the first one in my family to go to college and get a professional career. A friend of mine, his father, I respected him a lot, and I thought he was a great man. And I grew up in a single household, and he became
single parent
household, you know. And he became kind of a father figure, and I loved how he provided. So I followed in his footsteps as a career. You know, got an internship, became a financial advisor as soon as I got out of college. And I thought that, hey, you know, this is an opportunity to help my community, you know, by teaching them how to better manage their finances, because I hear about how, you know, we, the Latino community, minority communities, they're not building enough wealth to be comparable to the average communities in the United States, and there's a lot of barriers to entry to investments.
And there's economic predators that prey on minority communities,
exactly. So
particularly.
There were all these obstacles. So I thought, hey, this is going to be an opportunity for me to help, you know, like on a little bit and build something. And I did that for 10 years. And, you know, in working in the industry, I realized that it's really not meant to help. You know, it's the industry is carnivorous.
Sell, right?
Yeah, it's carnivorous. And so
James Baldwin said, by the African-American author, that it's if you've ever been poor, it's incredibly expensive to be poor.
Yes, that's 100% correct, and it's because of the predators, because of the barriers to entry, you know, not being able to buy a home in a place where your values appreciate, not having access to the financial market. So in any case, I did that. I did the best I could. I had a decent career there, made some money, you know, enough to be able to start my own business, which I do now. But towards the end of that career, as I was getting unhappy with just helping people with their advice, right, I started to look for opportunities to educate. And so I created within the bank at the time, I was working at Bank of America or the Merrill side, what we coined the Financial Literacy Advocacy Group, FLAG. Huh. And it was my first experience, and I wanted experience with nonprofits and dealing with C-suite executives and how the money will move. And getting that experience was important for me as a Latino as well, because we don't get a lot of those opportunities. It's another barrier to entry.
Right.
And I turns out just the way that I think, the way that I do things, I had a real knack for it. I created a program that was partnered with a dozen nonprofits in Phoenix. We were holding like 100 financial literacy classes a year. So I learned a lot about building teams and infrastructure. But I was also disappointed by how, you know, in doing all that, I was disappointed by how, one, we tell people they have to learn how to better manage their finances, but the system is creating things that are like impossible to manage, you know. So it's like you should learn, but at the same time, it's so complicated you can't do it.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to pass the buck. So that was frustrating.
So is it just that we're just pretending to teach people economic literacy?
Yes,
or
that was my realization, is that people are, even though you can teach somebody how to use a credit card, the way the credit cards work are, it's a game, you know, and it's a very bad game, like you shouldn't be playing.
The only way, it's like a nuclear war, the only way to win is not play.
Yeah, and so it just, I didn't feel good about it. And so I also didn't feel good how major corporations will partner with a nonprofit and use their brand to say, like, hey, we are this issue focused, but all they did was cut a $5,000 check and then slap the other company's brand on their marketing, and and, you know, photo op, and then that's that. Like, there's no substantive change.
There's a lot we can talk about that. Like, once again,
That's how I got out of financial literacy and into politics.
The Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly, because I was so disillusioned. I was like, I need to take up the responsibility of something that I know I can't put down. You know, and the responsibility was obvious, I guess, now in hindsight, but, you know, involved in government, involved in policy, this is a lifetime thing. You know, I've benefited from many policies, good policies, and the good work of people that came before me. It's my responsibility to continue that going forward because I understand it.
Damian, I want to talk about one of the other things that you've done, at least to try to get as much in as we can. White hat Democrats, the whole concept of white hat Democrats appeals to me. Now, talk about this evolution.
Well, originally what happened, you know, and listeners will get a candid shot of how things work in the party, you know, but it's there's a lot of turfs. You know, when a lot of people are involved, and if you're an unknown quantity, as I was when I first started, I was really engaged and I wanted to do, but there was just a lot of new people. I think that some Democrats closed their doors. You know, they're like, we want to wait this out because it was just like this deluge of new interest. We don't really know what you want. Yeah. So at first, you know, even with the best intentions, I was really hard to get a conversation going with the establishment, you know, Democrats, and trying to communicate, you know, precinct committee people is the way that we should be going. We need more programs around that. And I wasn't able to really move forward as well as I wanted to, as fast as I wanted to. So I started a separate organization. And I'm like, well, you know, it's one thing to tell me no within the organization or make it slow me down in any way, shape, or form. But if I recruit a dozen PCs and they all submit their applications and they're all registered voters and registered Democrats, you're going to come up with 12 excuses not to turn them away? So I don't think so.
You raised your own army.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it.
I
just start sending people in there, you know, and some were more engaged than others. As I mentioned, as a student of history, you may be familiar with what's known as the Terracotta Army. It's an ancient Chinese emperor built an entire army out of clay to thwart invaders. And I started looking at it, and it was like, well, I would rather have 10,000 names and only the same amount of people participating, you know, than have them blank. So we went and everybody signed up with the best intentions, you know, but at the same time, you never know how engaged someone's going to be, but you open the door for them. And what we did through White Hat Democrats is we took that entire application process and we just took it off their plate. We were like, all you got to do is sign here and we'll track the application from beginning to end, send you notifications, get it in the right place, and then you get your certificate in the end. So that's what we did, remove that barrier to entry. You know, explain to people why it's important to be a PC, why they need to be involved. They're already active. They joined, and then we take away the application pain, and we recruited literally hundreds and hundreds of PCs.
Karen, it's not that way up here, right?
It's a little different.
No, yeah. Lots of rural Arizona, and we struggle to find the people. And
The application
application up here consists of I'd like to be a PC.
Yes.
And next year when the elected comes up, we give them a piece of paper and say, get 10 signatures on this piece of paper, and you're a PC for the next 2 years. And we that's part just with numbers of people. Even the more democratic parts of rural Arizona tend to have a less formal structure because the whole county is not very big.
That's correct. So Pima and Maricopa are your two big ones, and they have a more unique structure in that the legislative districts have to sign off on the applications for the membership as well.
Yeah, it's very simple up here. If you want to be a PC, folks, right, Karen, tell folks, you can just become a PC.
Yeah.
If,
yeah.
if you can sign your name or and you have
10 friends.
You have 10 friends.
Yeah.
You have 10, and
relative.
Even if you don't have 10 friends, you can find 10 people who will sign as if you're friends. Yes. They have to be Democrats.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
So to end on the recruitment, so after time, you know, we recruited more people and more people, other groups started recruiting PCs as well. So it became a concerted effort on multiple fronts. And now the party has internalized that at multiple levels. So there wasn't a necessity for an organization like White Hat Democrats focused on PC recruitment to continue to exist, because the party is actually owning the responsibility, you know, as it should be. And there are people like myself who are now leading those things within the party to make sure that there's continuity.
So they've continued to make it easy to be a PC.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, getting appointed, getting elected. So things are just getting easier and easier to get engaged. You know, now we're focused really on the training. So we've, for example, digitized all of our training. And that's worked out really well because, as you know, in rural communities, or like anywhere that's not in the state of Maricopa, you know, it's harder to get presentations going. So having access to things on a digital platform really makes a big difference for just your average individual, whether, you know, they're disabled or hearing impaired or just lazy and don't want to go to an MX.
I used to talk years ago with people, the Republican leadership in Sedona and Yavapai County. They had some same complaints the Democrats went in of being sort of ignored because Maricopa is so huge and so important in elections. And we up here think Yavapai is like a really big county. But, you know, compared to a few square miles of Maricopa, we're not there. And so there was always a struggle to have the voice of the rural Democratic clubs and organizations to have a voice in the party. And what I saw is the party leadership was the people who kept the faith through the Reagan years and the really lean years for Democrats in Arizona, people who kept the faith and stuck to doing what they had been doing and inspired by Roosevelt or whatever way back. Mm-hmm. And they were still in charge of the party. And so I do think it was hard for them, having been isolated so long and carrying out the struggle with very little support, to accept the views of newcomers and stuff. It took them a while.
And it's hard, you know, and I think, like you said earlier, when you show up to the party, and that was my experience, is that there's just a lot of well-intentioned people, you know, and everyone is a volunteer. You know, that was a big surprise to me. You know, your entire legislative district, your counties, those are all just regular people who have other jobs and responsibilities. Some larger, you know, counties will have staff because they can raise the money to afford that, and maybe an office. They're big enough for that. But generally speaking, you know, the 16 board members that sit on, for example, the Arizona Democratic Board, we're all volunteers. You know, I woke up early, drove out here as a volunteer. There's no money in this for me, you know. It's
the Democratic Party in Arizona was extremely poor and was working on it. It was doing well given the difficulty of the situation here.
Let's talk
about but there weren't paid positions, so nobody folks is in what Damian's talking about. Nobody's going to pay you to toss turkeys to people in your precinct. It's all volunteer.
Yes. But it is a lot of fun to hand out candy to kids from the back of a pickup truck in the Sedona St. Patrick's Day.
That you can do.
But
they don't pay you for it, do they?
They don't pay.
Well.
In fact, they make you use your own truck, in my case. But I want to talk some numbers here, Damian. Vice President of the Arizona Democratic Party. Let's talk numbers. 4.5 million people in Phoenix. 5.5 million, over 5 million in Maricopa County. You call it the state of Maricopa. There's a reason for that. But I think one of the reasons we even get any interest up here, one of the reasons we get guests on our Democratic Perspective show, is that you guys are pretty divided evenly down there. And so places like Yavapai County or Flagstaff or Tucson can really make a difference if you, and so we get worked a little bit by candidates. Am I wrong? Am I right about
that? No, you're right. I mean, The work that we do is statewide, you know, so many of the elections, the positions are going to be statewide, and not everything is in Maricopa. Yes, you know, that's where you see most of the activity, but, you know, congressional seats span every corner of the state. Legislature seats do as well, so it's important that they get into those spaces, that we start pushing back what are considered just deep red, you know, areas. The state is becoming more progressive. It feels like it's hard to compete with Maricopa, at least on scale, but it'd be impossible. It's literally the largest growing county in all of the country. Yep. You know, everybody's going to be looking at it a little bit like, what's happening over there? But the work that's done in the counties outside of Maricopa, I think, is part of the fundamental game that we have to pay, or strategy that we have to employ, because there's a lot of money spent on these races. If we're not competitive in those races, then they won't spend as much money. We're not draining their resources. There's a lot that we can do with just having a human there and weakening a position, and also showing the individuals in those areas that we care enough to candidates and we care enough to have someone be there, as opposed to leaving an uncontested seat and which is kind of a slap in the face to every registered Democrat in that area who is like, well, they didn't even field a candidate.
In the last couple of election cycles, and Legislative District 6, mm-hmm. Congressional District 1 have been key races that people looked for the chances. We hold Congressional District 1 with Tom O'Halloran. Mm-hmm. We almost placed some winners in Legislative District 6 mm-hmm. last time, and we will win this time. But we're getting some attention because those are important areas. You know, because of the numbers in Arizona, as the legislature in Phoenix gets closer together, every one or two seats can make a huge difference.
Yeah,
so that's. But even before that thing, it also just from the plug in, is the party leadership on the all the vice chairs of the party, which you want, is a much more diverse group than there were before. There are more people, and they tend to be younger than they've been in the past. You're not alone. There's, I don't know how many of them are under 40, but
quite a number of the board of
the Democratic Party now is under 40, and there are several very active people who are from rural Arizona.
And it's exciting.
That's a change over maybe 8 or 10 years ago. They're putting their money where their mouth is. They really are trying to be a 15-state or 15-county party rather than a one-county
party.
Yeah,
and we do have that.
And we want to talk about that. We want to talk about these guys are willing to put their money where their mouth is. And just to review, LD6 is the legislature. That's where our state legislature comes from our area, our two representatives and our senator. And the congressional district, of course, is where our federal representative comes from. But based on what Karen said and based on what you said, Karen Kinsella is sitting in the background here, kind of runs the Cottonwood Democrats little group over there as part of the Yavapai County. Mm-hmm. So she can look forward to a check pretty soon is what all this is leading up from the Arizona Democratic Party.
They actually do. We invest grants into the county. So there's an entire process, you know, where the counties debrief, you know, after the elections and say, hey, this is where we need additional resources and help. They tell us, you know, what some of those – we have an idea of what we think they need, but we want them to tell us what they actually need. And then we cut checks. And I think those checks just went out recently to every single county to invest in the resources that they need. So
they're distributed through the county party, and our Yavapai County chairman has looked at that and he's talked, you know, about what they can do to help us. This is, you know, Yavapai County is split between two legislative districts. Mm-hmm. One of which should be able to be won, one of which is very, very red and not, so they're looking at putting some of those county resources towards our legislative district, which includes only a small part of Yavapai County and includes parts of three other counties.
What's the money going to be used for, Karen?
They've actually talked about, I don't know how far they've gotten on the Yavapai County Board, about looking to use the money towards hiring an intern, perhaps having somebody based in the Cottonwood, Verde Valley area, starting next year for the election season, some, you know, a volunteer, an intern to help organize canvasses, to help organize the PCs, to provide a resource and a flow of information.
DOOR has a full-time office,
yeah.
And you guys fund it completely yourselves,
yeah,
right? Why don't you tell folks where it is and how to get contact?
Yeah, we do have a full-time office in Sedona. It's at 105 Roadrunner Drive, Suite 2. That's the little plaza right across the street from the City Hall. It's easy to find. And we're open every day right now from 11 to 2, Monday through Friday. There's someone there. And that will be used as a base. It can be a base for the candidates, for canvassing, for phone banking, as we get more into that aspect of the election season when we're doing that sort of candidate operation, for also places for people to leave literature and information for everyone.
And right now we're really building capacity, bringing more people on board, training, getting ready for, you know, the election season, you know, the next cycle that's coming up, the next legislative session. That's you know, it's all infrastructure to a large extent.
Well, that's it. And Barack Obama, you know, started his career as community organizer. It's it is a big deal. It is an important thing. But I don't want to toss off this 11 to 2 hours of the Democrats at the Red Rocks office here in Sedona. The fact they do have an office in Sedona is wildly exciting to at least the people in this room. But the 11 to 2s, it bothers me. I mean, 3 hours a day is a tough. I have a favorite brewery in Cottonwood, and they're only open 4 to, this is the analogy, they're only open 4 to 8. That's a tough target to hit. You know, I want to support them. I want to buy their beer, but I only got from 4 to 8 to hit it. So 11 to 2 is a tough target to hit. So how can, go ahead.
More volunteers. I mean, that's an interim sort of period. You know, it covers, you know, the middle of the day. We, you know, when people are maybe off, if they're working, there might be a lunch, they're in town shopping, you know, they're more likely to be available, which in those hours will expand as we get closer to the election. Mm-hmm. And there are more candidate-focused things we're doing. This morning at the breakfast, our Kathy Rutherford, who's the DOOR president, talked about the neighbor-to-neighbor sort of organization. So we're doing some canvassing, but it's more based on, I have names of 20, 30, 40, 50 people in my neighborhood to go out and talk to, but on more generic democratic principles, not strictly be sure to vote in 2020 and or to vote for a certain person. So as the whole process starts to shift next year into candidates running for office and the things with the presidential preference primary in Arizona in the spring, all of those things, then the office hours will expand as there's more things going on. A lot of things now going on are being done sort of in the community individually.
To some extent, you need to talk to people about the sort of thing that Damien is talking about. Something about the structure, something beyond just you need to get out and vote. You need another message.
Well, it's also what Karen is alluding
education
to.
Education on the things.
The educational and just basic democratic policy. I mean,
what the issues are.
Speaking of this unnamed brewery. You're talking to someone that's working for less than $15 an hour, and yet they don't believe that $15 an hour would put their employer and some would put them broke, would put them out of business, would cause their brother or their uncle to lose their job. In other words, having a living wage, they believe, is not a good thing. So I'm trying to listen to this person speaking not in their own self-interest and yet not jump on the bar and call him a fool and kick him in the face.
And it's not just Republicans who have a lot of these misinformation.
Very importantly, it's not just Republicans. Yeah.
No,
and it's
just
not just
the human condition more than anything.
Well, that's the purpose of the off-year time, and that's the purpose, as Damien said, is his PC recruiting organization is now trying to become a Democratic think tank. And I know they've done commissioning of like white papers and commissioning people to do research on issues and provide background information that can be used to help educate people and to help people who are speaking on issues have the proper information.
That's something Democrats have never had.
So you've created a think tank at the Arizona Democratic Party. I'm
sorry. Yes and no. It's
somebody.
Not. Well, yeah, I created a think tank, but it's not under the umbrella of the Democratic Party.
Oh.
It's bipartisan. It's registered, as a separate nonprofit.
All right.
And you know, as we started moving away from the responsibilities of recruiting human resources, you know, at the point, we started thinking as a group, and you know, about the overarching strategy that got us to where. How did the opposition put us in the situation that we're in today?
Yeah.
And you most likely are familiar with the Golden Water Institute.
Absolutely.
Based out of Arizona. You've got organizations like ALEC,
American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah, exactly. And they
provides most of the laws that we live with, the right-wing laws that we live with the last 30 years. Go ahead.
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you have these organizations, which were separate at some point, but, you know, as they grew, the Goldwater Institute became what's considered a conservative think tank, and that feeds research and model legislation, as well as taking cases to court, you know, to ensure that that law is upheld. They have, for many decades, been very organized in providing their legislators.
And well-funded.
And well-funded, yes, and providing talking points, model legislation, all the things that legislators and the communities need to beat us back. Mm-hmm. And so when we started looking at that problem, we noted specifically in the landscape of Arizona that there is no such thing as a progressive think tank. We have, you know, the conservative, and then you have things like Grand Canyon, you know, but they bill themselves as a centrist think tank. You know, and as you may be aware, we've been pulled so far to the right that sometimes the middle is kind of a big swath. It's kind of a big swath now. So you know, we're looking to fight back on, you know, having this intellectual battle, providing the ammunition that others will need to have to make cogent arguments and winning arguments. Even though you can say that people vote their emotions and this and that, without winning the actual argument or framing the argument properly, you're already at a disadvantage.
Good candidates can't swim in an ocean of misinformation.
Yeah.
And the reason we formed Democratic Perspective was the ocean was so biased and so conservative, and the ideas were so systematically wrong, and we decided to
They were lies. They were out-and-out lies.
Yeah,
we had, until the election of George W. Bush, until 2000, we had never had such an onslaught of lies. Now, the current occupier of the Oval Office has made this a franchise business. I mean, this is so incredible now. But I believe when we started this show, this little progressive, we consider it progressive. Even then, lots of people will consider this pretty middle of the road because we've been pulled so far right.
Mm-hmm.
If we were progressive, Tom would have thrown us out of here years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the other aspect for what Damien started is once we turn Arizona blue, once you have a majority of the legislature, you need the think tanks doing what the Goldwater Institute has done, writing the model legislation, because the legislators we elect, that's not their expertise. You need to have someone putting together the actual words, the research reports, the white papers, the background information that we're going to need after 2020 so we can actually – you know, in Arizona, we can propose good laws.
Yeah,
we've been in the minority so long, you have to have something ready to go. Mm. You have to have people working on this idea that once the Speaker of the House is a Democrat, they have places to go to get the research and the information.
That's 100%. Yeah. Or things that you know, they can submit legislation even that may not be passing, but they can start to create a theme or put it in the queue pretty much so that when things happen.
Just to connect all the dots for our listeners, we had Nancy McLean on here a year ago. She wrote a book called Democracy in Chains. And the idea was she traced the 40 years or 50 years that it took the other side since Brown versus Board of Education in 1953 that scared the crap out of them. These brown and black people are actually going to be wanting some power in this country, and they spent 40 years getting us to the right-wing hell we're in today. So your think tank is planting seeds now that will give fruit, perhaps.
Should people contact it? Do you have a contact? What people can do to help you out?
Yeah, you're welcome to visit the website. It's a simple acronym, WHRPG. .org stands for White Hat Research and Policy Group. You're able to download our first paper there, specifically on ESAs, with those school vouchers, and where they come from and the insidious nature of how they defund our public system. our public school system. So that's a good start. We have a few more papers in the pipeline, one in charter school governance.
Don't forget, folks, we need to – I'm sorry, Damon. We got to wrap this up here. Democratic Perspective, VVID.org. All our podcasts are there. Please listen to and hit the donate button, Democratic Perspective, and watch us on Facebook and listen to us in Borneo because we're all over the Internet. Thanks, folks.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.